So good morning, everyone. Excuse me, that was a good start, wasn't it? Good morning, everyone, and particular thanks to Christine and Tamar and to Jonathan for such a kind invite to be here in such company. I'm calling this talk Open Source Tones of Voice, and it's going to examine, by way of illustration, three different types of participatory design, three different ways in which the people for whom and with whom design is being carried out, embedded in the design process itself. It occurs to me that a lot of the speakers yesterday were talking about the participation of people who don't have a voice in a particular context. This particular research is all themed around people who literally cannot speak. And that's not contrived for the purposes of this colloquium. It just happens to be the focus of my research, but maybe that's interesting. So I've called the three modes of participatory design co-designing tone of voice, opening up tone of voice, and open source tone of voice, although I might change the title of the last of those three as a result of the conversations that happened today. So the first one, co-designing tone of voice, the example is a project undertaken by Samir Shaban and Johanna van Dalen, which there are more details of in my book than I've got time to go into today. At the time of this co-design, Samir Shaban was a teenager using to communicate a communication sheet, which meant that her communication sheet, she would point to words and concepts and co-create sentences with the person she was speaking to. That's very laborious and quite restricted in terms of what she could say. So she chose to spend her collaboration with the designer Johanna van Dalen on producing the badge that you see here. It's a nice friendly red badge. It sits on her chest, and most of the time it says Samia. So that's good because you know what her name is. But there's a wire connected from it going to a head switch. And when Samia moves her head and operates the switch, the badge displays the words, Samia says sod off. And that's very important to Samia. It's very important at the time. It gave her a way of spontaneously expressing frustration in a way that was edited out of her rather sanitized, prescribed communication sheet. Now, what I like about this piece is that it's a wonderful piece of co-design. It was absolutely created by the design team, was both Samir and Johanna. And minute by minute, Samir gets to express this sentiment. But it does so much more than that. Even when it's not being used, the presence of this badge projects something about Samir. It projects that she is the kind of person who occasionally says sod off to people. And not only that, but that's so important to her, she's prepared to dedicate a switch to it. And these are both delightful projections of Samir's identity. It's the writer Tom Shakespeare makes a distinction in his book Disability Rights and Wrongs between badges that are created by the individual and labels that are ascribed to them by other people. And this is very definitely a badge of Samir's making. And I think it's really interesting because beyond its role for Samir, I would certainly say it has a role as a piece of critical design because it invites reflection on the nature of communication aids. In one sense, it's a very inefficient communication aid, all that hardware dedicated to just one statement. But in another way, it's incredibly articulate and rich and efficient. Okay. The second project is one of my own. It's a collaboration with my research partner, Andrew Cook. And this is about tone of voice in the sense of intonation or prosody and the role that plays in speech, particularly in languages such as English and French, where it's not just the words you choose, but the way that you say them that conveys your meaning and intent. And the fact that that is so conspicuous by its absence in most communication aids, which at the moment are built on text-to-speech, literally text-to-speech technology. Now, what we wanted to do was start a conversation about what tone of voice meant to people without speech. And that was sort of doubly challenging because apart from the communication issues inherent in that group, tone of voice itself is an incredibly elusive quality. We recognize it when we hear it, but even phoneticians struggle to describe it and transcribe it and define it. So the procedure we followed was to find magpie-like lots of different disciplines who had their own ways and their own agendas for thinking about tone of voice, be they academic or creative disciplines, but then to bring those different models back to a common medium, a medium of literally six speaking chairs, each of which embodied one of those models of thinking about tone of voice in a way that made it accessible not just to people from other disciplines, but to lay people. The intent being just to facilitate a discussion about what tone of voice means to us with the people that matter. So the first chair is an embodiment of text-to-speech as it's defined at the moment. Someone like Stephen Hawking, using a communication aid, has this ironic imbalance between words and tone. He can laboriously type in any word he wants to, but the only recourse he has to how those words get spoken is by adding a full stop, an exclamation mark, or a question mark to the end of a sentence, and then there's a kind of limited effect of those. So this takes keys from a computer keyboard, that paradigm of text entry, and they are the only controls. Another chair in the series is an embodiment of those phoneticians' diagrams that I flashed up in the first slide. Phoneticians use those little diagrams of intonation to transcribe tone of voice after the event. This back drives that. It's a little touch screen. It lets you actually drive speech in real time by drawing that diagram in the first place. And then the last of the six chairs is this one. This is based on, rather than an academic discipline, a creative discipline. It's based on the way that playwrights at least used to, in the past, transcribe the ways that they wanted their lines to be spoken by actors. These, I don't know if you can read them from where you're sitting, these phrases are all taken from George Bernard Shaw's script for Pygmalion that's almost 100 years old. I'll read out a few of them. They're lovely. Appreciatively, brusquely, coaxing, coyly, explosively, protesting, roaring, reflectively. There's a few more that I'd love to include. In Pygmalion, one of the stage directions is with the roar of a wounded lion, which would that'd be a wonderful tone to have on a communication aid, probably under a little flap with a red button in case you pushed it inadvertently. But the most important thing in this context is the 18th doorbell is missing, and there's a little white pencil and the invitation to please customize. Now, wherever we've gone with the chairs, and in fact, it's a nice coincidence that their first airing was here in Montreal in 2008 at the International Society of Augmentative and Alternative Communication. We've then invited audience members, people without speech, speech and language therapists, other people in that domain, as well as speech technologists and specialists in this area, to write down which 17 tones of voice they would choose if they were restricted to just 17 for the rest of their lives. And the results are always absolutely fascinating. And when I've collated those, even with a sample of just 40 or 50 people, the number of distinct descriptions coming back is in the hundreds. Very, very, you know, it's orders of magnitude away from where we are at the moment with these three tones of voice. One thing I find fascinating is that when lay people without speech, members of the public, participate in this, they tend to mix up very liberally different perspectives of describing tone of voice in the first place. So sometimes people are reaching for a social context to define a tone of voice. They'll talk about wanting to speak deferentially or confidentially or respectfully. Sometimes they're talking about conversational intent, wanting to plead or insist. Sometimes it is about their emotional state, their internal emotional state. So they want to sound pleased or anxious. And sometimes it's a direct description of a vocal quality. They'll talk about whispering or using a rich voice or a deep voice or a high voice. And I think what's interesting in this context is that, there's quite a balance between those different perspectives in the results that we've had back. I think what's challenging about that insight in this space is that it challenges the incredibly prevalent model of emotional markup for speech, which is dominating nearly all of the speech technology research that I know of. And so what's interesting, it asks more questions than it answers. You know, what would happen if we tried to bring to speech technology development the perspective that lay people have, rather than that speech technologists or emotional researchers bring to bear. Which leads me on to the third project, which again is an illustrative project. Its intent is to start new conversations about possibilities rather than being a literal proposal. And I'll just show a short video to let it introduce itself before I go into some more detail. So, if I can do this.
So it needs to be polite.
Yes.
And formal.
Yes.
And slightly questioning.
Yes.
No, that doesn't work.
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
That looks interesting.
Yes.
I think I'll keep that.
Excuse me. I gave you a 20.
Okay, so to pick up on some of the issues that you'll have seen played out in the video, it's a challenging area because already for people using speech technology to communicate, speed of communication is already an issue. So we've got to be careful when dreaming of more expressive speech synthesis, that there isn't so much of an overhead in actually making that choice, that conversation slows down even more. And so an important part of this conversation piece is the idea of having two user interfaces, one of which is used away from conversation, away from a live situation, with a large screen for creating, collecting, and curating tones of voice to be used in conversation, and then a much more restricted, quicker user interface for use in conversations, where someone has been able to collect their own palettes of tone of voice for use in different social contexts. The point being that this would still be a very restricted choice. It would need to be fast enough in conversation, but it's a palette that the person using the communication aid has decided themselves, rather than one that's been prescribed to them by the manufacturers of the speech technology. And that's the important distinction. Contained within it are still reminders of how those tones are built up, because it needs to be, it would need to be engaging, so that more tones could be created as opportunities arose. So, and again, as with the chairs exercise, this has been a trigger for further discussions and participatory exercises. In this case, we've had members of audiences and participation groups make up their own plants for expressing particular tones of voice. These are 39 ways to say sarcastically, sourced from different people. It's kind of interesting in terms of seeing how intuitive such an interface might be, but actually has exposed far more interesting effects about the different ways that people, which people think about speech. I can't go into too much detail here, but I've got two examples of sarcastically from one of those participatory groups, and they're different, but they're different not just because the individuals have reached for different leaves. They're actually trying to create different sounds. The one on the left, which we checked back with the participants, is quite a sort of underhand sarcasm. It's a way of getting confrontation to masquerade as politeness. The one on the right is far more theatrical. It's an exaggerated sarcasm, a far more blatant sarcasm. And I think that really begs the question that even if the technology is too advanced, who is it to define what sarcasm sounds like? If we're looking for more sophisticated communication, sophistication on whose terms? I think that's the most important question. So what this project anticipates is the emergence of subcultures devised by the people using this technology themselves. And I think one interesting precedent for me as a designer is Adobe has a site called Cooler, which lets graphic designers post up color palettes that they've devised for their own work. And exchange them and trade them, and even more importantly, critique and rate each other's color palettes. And it's very interesting, both in the social interaction that you see on that site, but also as down to the names that people use to describe these color palettes. You see subcultures emerging. It's very, very interesting. So we imagined what would happen if Adobe, a similar approach was taken for tone of voice. So I guess just to finish up painting this picture, what we're anticipating or speculating about, it's more speculative, is a large and growing pool of user-defined tones of voice, and then each person using a communication aid could choose their own relationship with that group, with that pool. They could just craft their own tones of voice and use them to speak in isolation. They could sample and collect tones of voice that other people had created. Or they could post their own online and actually contribute to that pool. And what I think would be fascinating, and we're at the stage with this, I'm working very closely with people who know a lot more about speech technology than I do, the Centre for Speech Technology Research at the University of Dundee, at the University of Edinburgh. Who are the people behind the spin-off that digitized Roger Ebert's voice, the American film critic, very much at the cutting edge of speech technology worldwide. What's interesting about this is we believe this is actually feasible, and it's feasible because at the end of the day, the technology is not trying to predict what the tone will sound like. That's something that is described after the event, after a more exploratory process by the people in the system themselves. Not just because they're more intelligent, but their subjectivity is actually key to this. Tone of voice has cultural and social resonances as well as emotional. So we've put together a proposal to actually build this system as a pilot study and to see what emerges. I very much liked Raphael's maxim that participation has to be out of control. And so by building this, only by building it, would we see what roles might emerge within this community. I think in more general terms, I'm interested in some implications that go beyond this particular instance. This is you may recognize this, the artifact on the left is a leg splint designed by Charles and Ray Eames in the Second World War for American service personnel, injured American service personnel. A very traditional medical brief, you could say. In meeting that brief, they perfected their technique of forming plywood into complex curvature. And it was this brief that both informed and inspired their iconic mainstream furniture that had such an influence on 20th century design as a whole. And I think similarly my aspiration for some of this exploratory work in speech technology is that this very particular and unparalleled profound use of speech technology could actually be the crucible in which new interactions with speech technology for all of our lives are forged. So actually letting things go out of control and putting that control back into the hands of people for whom speech technology is an intimate part of their everyday lives already seems like a very exciting proposition. Okay, thank you very much.